Hello and welcome to the Much More Podcast, the podcast that aims to help you be more, to be able to reach your fullest potential, and then to be able to give more in terms of that potential. I am your host, Mark Miller, and I'm excited to bring you this one. Let's get into it. Welcome to the Much More Podcast. I'd like to welcome the mental health comedian. He has dealt with and walked in major depressive disorder, chronic suicidality. He has shared his experience through 6 TEDx talks. He's an educator and coach in suicide prevention, a motivational speaker. He uses his life experience to give others permission to start talking about life-saving conversations around suicide and depression. He was a writer for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno for over 20 years. In the midst of all of this, he still finds place to laugh and enjoy elements of life because he firmly believes where there is humor, there is hope. Welcome to the man himself, Mr. Frank King.
How are you? Morning, good evening, good night, wherever you are.
Thank you so much for joining us here. And like, if I didn't catch anything else, is there anything that you would like to just tell the audience a little bit more about yourself? Most of my listeners being in South Africa, a few in America, and then a few in Asia as well.
Yep, American, live on the West Coast in Oregon, the People's Republic of Oregon. And I started my career on stage as a comedian back day after Christmas, 1985. And I was dating a woman. I said, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comedian. You want to come along? Thinking she'd go, oh, hell no. And she goes, yeah. So she and I were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, no home, just a P.O. box and an answer. Worked with comedians whose names you would recognize, Jerry Seinfeld, Jeff Foxworthy, Ron White, Adam Sandler, and opened up for a number of musical acts in that 7-year journey, and then did a little radio. And after I got done with radio, because I got fired, as you would, there are two kinds of people in radio, people who've been fired, people that are going to be fired, did the corporate comedy circuit for a while. And then the last recession hit, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. We lost everything into bankruptcy. Chapter 7, they call it here. Everything we'd worked for in 25 years. That's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. Literally. Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. A friend of mine thought it'd be funny. He came up after one of my keynotes. He goes, hey, man, how come we didn't pull the trigger? I go, hey, man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed? I know. So when the recession ended, the meeting planner said to me, Frank, we love you. We can't pay you that kind of money anymore just to be funny. You got to teach our audience something. So I was like, I have no idea. I always wanted to make a living and a difference, but just had no idea how. And then I read a book by a woman named Judy Carter. Judy Carter. It's called The Message of You, Turn Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. I thought, well, that subtitle is very specific. So I read the book. About halfway through, I thought, son of a gun, I do have something to talk about. So I decided I would take some suicide prevention training and keynote on suicide prevention using my lived experience, my story to open up. And that was a great idea with one small catch is I've been a comedian forever. Everybody thought of me as a comedian. Yeah. Nobody thought of me as a serious speaker. So that's when I decided I would do a TEDx talk to rebrand. And I did my first TEDx talk in 2014. And I decided I would come out on stage as depressed and suicidal. Nobody knew. My family, my wife, my friends, nobody had any idea how close I'd come to killing myself. And I live with chronic suicidal ideation and major depressive disorder. And I came out on stage in that talk. And I got a call from two other TEDx events that said, do you have any more mental health topics? Oh, yeah. So I did my next two TEDx. And then I applied for the following 3, all of them on mental health, one aspect or another. Mm-hmm. My favorite, actually, is my 5th one. It's called Mental Health and the Orgasm, Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly. And I didn't even have to audition for that. They said, no, you're on. It's the only one I've ever gotten a standing ovation. Yeah, it's the only one I've ever gotten a standing ovation for. And it allowed me to rebrand. All those reinforced my brand as the mental health comedian. That's my brand.
Yeah.
I believe if you're speaking for a living or whatever you're doing as an entrepreneur, you need to do one thing, no side hustles, and do it very well. And you got to figure out who your ideal clients are. Who needs what you have to offer? And I realized that there's a top 10 list of at-risk occupations for suicide in the U.S. So I only market to the top 5 or 6 at-risk occupations for suicide. Mm. Makes the marketing a whole lot easier if you're very, very specific in who you're going after, because they all have a high rate of suicide. They're all trying to do something about it. So it's not like I got to sell them on the idea. Yeah, suicide prevention, it's a great thing.
Yeah.
They all know that. They just have to figure out which suicide prevention speaker they're going to book. And I mean, come on. Who would you rather have talking about death, dying, mortality, morbidity? A clinician?
Yeah.
Or a comedian? Come on.
Fair enough. Okay, so mental health often has a dark connotation. Doesn't need to be, right? But it's the connotation that's out there is that if I've got mental health problems, there's something wrong with me and I need to hide in a corner and not show my face. I think the rhetoric is changing for sure.
Yep.
But I think it's just great just listening to a few of your TEDx's that I could find on YouTube and search around is the fact that you do acknowledge that there should be a lighter side to it and not to make the situation or the problem itself, let's put that way, or the pathology that you're dealing with light, but there is a lightness. And often you say that your greatest material came from dark places. And I mean, the statistic shows that a majority of comedians have had an element of a mental.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a friend of mine from Canada, Mike McDonald, once said, there's two kinds of comedians, diagnosed, undiagnosed.
Yeah.
And it runs in my family. It's called generational depression and suicide. My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days. And if you're that close to a suicide and you're already hardwired for it, the chance of you thinking seriously about taking your life go up. So people ask me, how'd you pick suicide as a topic? Well, you know what? The topic actually picked me.
Yeah,
I don't have to. It wasn't like I thought, what am I going to talk about? Oh, suicide prevention. That would be.
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Don't just pick these things out of a hat, right? And as we were mentioning,
just before we
actually got onto the actual podcast, is that like a psychologist often will go into psychology and then go into therapy, and because they went through something and they experienced what therapy has done for them, et cetera, et cetera. So there is this causation within it. From your side as a comedian, what does being mentally healthy look like for you? What is that?
Yeah. Well, I have a self-care plan, and I've got a keynote on that called Social Distancing and Staying Sane. Don't worry so much about your mentally ill friends, because most of my mentally ill friends are high functioning and they've got a self-care plan. They had a self-care plan before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you have mental illness, you wake up in an uncertain world every day, whether there's a pandemic or not.
Yep.
So it's diet. I'm on a keto diet. Exercise, try to exercise at least five times a week, meditation, medication. And because I'm chronically suicidal, ironically, because I'm willing to kill myself at any moment, that helps keep me alive, because I believe that suicide most often is not about wanting to kill yourself. It's more about wanting to end the pain. And knowing I can end the pain at any moment, I can stand a great deal more pain because I'm in control and I can always end that if I chose to. I don't plan to, but the option is always there.
That's quite an interesting frame. And I think it'll be a very hard concept for listeners to understand, because
people look at me like,
I think when you say that on stage, everyone's going to be like, I need a second to process that.
But yeah. Well, because it sounds a bit counterintuitive. But yeah, another friend has said one time to me, if it weren't for my chronic suicidal ideation, I would have killed myself a long time ago. And he explained what he meant. And I realized, oh my God, that's me as well.
Yeah.
That's why, one of the reasons I'm still here.
Yeah. Cause you know that it's an option. So you're like, I can actually take a bit more. It seems a bit counterintuitive. It's like, well, where's the point that you can't take anymore? And yeah, I always say to people, like, you're stronger than you realize, but you're not as strong as you think. And they're like, okay, that doesn't make too much sense. I'm like, you can go through a lot more, but there's going to come a point where you can feel that breakdown coming. And it's understanding where that threshold is for you. And unfortunately, we find it in ways that we shouldn't be finding it. And that's normally by enduring. And there's a very stoic philosophy that I'm speaking about here, is that life sometimes is just to be endured. And that sounds terrible when you say that. In enduring life and then going through the hardships, you find all the beauty in it too. Have you experienced that in your journey?
Well, in the United States, I don't know if this is true around the world, but in the United States, they call it toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, it was called Big Boys Don't Cry, which I think is far more descriptive. One of the reasons that construction has the highest rate of suicide of any occupation, at least in the U.S., is because it's male heavy, mostly men. Men who are rough and tough, who aren't really the kind of guy who would reach out for help. And I didn't realize how bad it was. I did some presentations for a big construction company in New York in January, and I looked it up because I knew they were number one. In 2018, which is the last year they had figures for, 1,008 people died in construction accidents. 1,008.
Yeah.
Suicides, 5,242 same year.
Wow.
Which means you have a 5 times greater chance of jumping off a building than falling off a building, which is crazy. That's why I knew they were number one. I didn't know they were number one that far ahead.
Yeah.
So, but you know, again, male heavy. 8 out of 10 people who die by suicide in the U.S. Today are men. Again, because of the, you know, big boys don't cry. Men don't reach out.
And I mean,
so the stoicism can kill you.
It's being impartial can also kill you. And the thing is, like, this conversation, although we're speaking it quite abruptly, there's a lot of seriousness to the weight of what we're actually speaking about here.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's not something that I'm taking lightly at all. And it's because I'm very aware that there could be somebody who's listening, who's thought about killing themselves over and over again, right? Almost getting on that thought. And I don't want to take away from what they're going through, right? The trauma that they have had experienced, the things that they tell themselves, how they speak to themselves. It's quite important to acknowledge that. I think what's great here is also for them to realize and acknowledge that, yeah, they're not necessarily alone in this space.
Every time I've spoken since 2014 and told my story about having chronic suicidal ideation, what I say is, for me and people in my tribe, chronic suicidal ideation means that suicide is always an option on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. And when I say small, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had 3 thoughts, unbidden. 1, get it fixed. 2, buy a new one. 3, I could just kill myself. That's chronic suicidal ideation. And every time I've spoken since 2014, there's been at least one person in the audience, sometimes more, who have that, who were unaware that it had a name. They just thought they were some kind of freak and completely alone. I had a young woman come up after a college presentation and say, "Thank you for your keynote." I said, "You're welcome." She said, "But I got to tell you, it made me weep." I said, "How did it make you weep?" She said, "Well, you know your story about the car, get it fixed, buy a new one, you can just kill yourself." I said, "Yes." She goes, "I've been having those thoughts all my life. I had no idea that I had a name. I thought I was some kind of freak and completely alone. And when I heard you say that out loud, I realized for the first time in my life that I'm not, in fact, alone." And I wept just by opening your mouth and sharing your story and being vulnerable. Other people find that it gives them permission to give voice to their feelings and experience.
It's interesting that just speaking about it does. It definitely gives people permission. In those moments, right, where someone goes and tells you this, because I'm sure you've had multiple people tell you that, "Hey, what you spoke about has touched me deeply." What is your biggest takeaway from that? Like, what, from your side being on the other side, because their experience with you is one thing, but what is your biggest takeaway from your experience with the audience?
First TEDx, and it's my tagline, which is start the conversation. Mm-hmm. Because if you start the conversation, you break the silence, which allows the possibility of breaking the stigma. And again, it gives people in the audience permission to give voice to those feelings and experiences. And people tell me things they've never told anybody else. That's my takeaway, is I feel like George Bailey in that old movie, It's a Wonderful Life. I think I've been shown what people's lives might be like if I were not there to simply let them know that it's a thing and they're not alone and so forth. And if I killed myself, then theoretically I would take some of those people with me who never had a chance to hear me say those things. Somebody's got to be unafraid to lead the freak parade. And that's my job. I let my freak flag fly and rally my tribe.
And I think it's an important flag to fly so people know where they can go, that there is somebody. You are somebody who understands and you've got a lot of knowledge about the topic, and it's something that you can teach on, right? Because there is a stigma of, "Oh, I've got to go see a therapist." I mean, especially here in South Africa, it's still stigmatized. And I'm sure probably parts of the States as well. I think it's maybe.
Yeah.
And it's nice to know that there's somebody else who isn't a therapist who understands it.
And I put my phone number up on the screen, my cell number, every time I speak. And I tell the audience, look, if you're suicidal, call the hotline or text the text line. If you're just having a bad day, call a crazy person. Here's my cell. people call and text. When I did the shows in New York, I did 7 keynotes in 2.5 days for 1,000 construction workers on site in a building that they're putting up in Manhattan. You know, and I said to the audience, look, we'll do a little general Q&A. And then when we get done with the general Q&A, if you have a question you don't want to ask in front of everybody, like, hey, I'm crazy, can you help me? Then I'll hang out and answer your questions. And then I gave my cell number as well. So the next morning, I wake up. I got several more keynotes to give that day, and I turn my phone on, and there's a text, and it's a New York number that I don't recognize, and it simply says, "Can I get that number again for help?"
I'm just going to jump into the middle of the podcast here real quick to tell you about a resource that I've created that'll help you set a goal. As you know, setting goals can be quite daunting, and we just get inundated with it and we don't plan accordingly. So this free resource will help you plan and structure a goal that is attainable to your psychology. So check that out. The link of that is in the description below. The second part of this is, as we are speaking about a topic that is quite difficult and can be daunting, and if you're like Frank King that had chronic suicidal ideation or thoughts on suicide, please get the help that you need. There's a link below that you can click from the International Association of Suicide Prevention. And they're a really good organization that you can find help in your country and speak to somebody that can help you through these thoughts. Or alternatively, you may be able to send me an email. I will reach out to you and we can have a chat, but it will be so good for you to get the correct help that you need if you're in this space. So the link of those are below. Enjoy the rest of the podcast. Let's get back into it.
So maybe somebody didn't want to ask a question during the general Q&A, didn't want to come up and be seen talking to me, mm-hmm. you know, individually, but reached out by way of text, and it made me cry. And then when I told the story to the audience that morning, I cried again, and I said, I didn't weep, but I got choked up, and I said, I guess big boys do cry.
Yeah.
So that's the power of starting the conversation. You give people permission to give voice. A friend of mine who works for one of the big mental health nonprofits here in the U.S. says, Frank, I'm the permission fairy. I mentioned the words depression and suicide out loud, and all of a sudden people just throw up all over me emotionally. It happens every time. It's mm-hmm. like they've been waiting for somebody to come along and utter those words, you know, those magic words, depression and suicide, to give voice to it. So that's really my job. My clients oftentimes tell me, look, we just brought you in here to start the conversation.
Why do you think that people are waiting for that permission? Because I've noticed it myself, right?
There's a stigma associated with mental illness, and there's also a separate stigma associated with thoughts of suicide. People are terrified, you know, neurotypicals are terrified by the thought of suicide. And if you told somebody who's neurotypical that you're having thoughts of suicide, two things. One, either they're afraid they're going to say the wrong thing,
yeah.
or they just don't know what to say. There's a myth that you should never mention the S word, suicide, in front of somebody who's depressed, because it might give them the idea. Wow, suicide. Yeah. What a great idea. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
Trust me, it's crossed their mind.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are lots of myths like that. You know, and I try to bust the myth, like, it's not about killing yourself. It's probably more about ending the pain. You know, you definitely should mention the word suicide in front of somebody who's depressed, because there's a better chance then that they will not attempt the suicide if you have talked about it, brought it up.
It's unfortunately, I think that also goes down to early schools of thought within psychology, right? There was this notion that you are almost imprinting the ideation into their mind by bringing it up, came through that actually you should talk about it. Because it creates awareness, and they're like, oh, actually, I'm not alone in my thoughts. Interestingly enough, how did it affect you doing comedy and your humor, having this thought in the back of your head? I'm sure maybe while you were on stage, you're probably like, these people in front of me don't really know that I'm dealing with suicidal ideation almost on a daily basis, if not daily. There must have been an element where you're like, how can I try and make people laugh when inside I am feeling a certain way?
Well, I come on stage and I address the elephant in the room. Oftentimes, almost always, I say, I know what you're thinking. A comedian talking about depression and suicide, how does that work? Yeah. So I talk about my family history. And then I talk about my, you know, coming close to killing myself. And then I reveal that I have major depressive disorder and chronic suicidal ideation. And I describe that. Before I get into anything beyond that, they already know it runs in my family, that I've come close to killing myself, that I have two mental illnesses. So you can almost see the people who have mental challenges lean forward. because all of a sudden they realize it's not theoretical for me.
Yeah.
This is not, you know, I'm not a clinician. It's very near and dear to my heart. And I try to educate the neurotypicals as well, like bust the myth about not mentioning the word suicide and explain to them that it's not about dying so much as it is about ending the pain. So I'm trying to educate, reach out and relate to both groups so that if they have a loved one who is living with a mental illness, they'll be better equipped to, or if they have a mental illness, they'll feel more comfortable coming forward. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, people have an impression in their minds about what mental illness looks and sounds like. And if you see a guy on stage who wrote jokes for Leno for 20 years, The Tonight Show, and a comedian for 35 full time, and obviously high functioning, and it's hard to hold that in your mind at the same time with whatever your previous image was of people with mental illness. If you can change perception, you can change prejudices. And if you can change prejudices, you can reduce stigma and bullying and hopefully eventually suicide.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's important to acknowledge it through the work that you're doing. But did it ever, like, for instance, right, you wrote for Jay Leno for 20 years, and I'm sure you had suicidal ideation in that time.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's just a passing thought. It's just like, get it fixed, buy a new one, or kill myself. Well, there's a good idea. Or I'm sitting in a railroad tracks watching a train coming and thinking, well, you know, pull up on the tracks, that would do it. Or driving down the road, see a bridge abutment, think, you know, if I just turn the wheel a little bit, all done. Yeah. All in, all done, as they say in auctioneering. So I've lived with it for so long. The young woman who came up and at the college event we talked about, she said, I was hoping I would grow out of it, the suicidal ideation. I said, honey, I'm 65. If I'm going to grow out of it, I better get started because, you know, I've got that much time left.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, it's a coping mechanism. It's just a way for my brain. You know, my brain always offers that up as option C. You can do this, you can do that, or you can just kill yourself.
Going back to what we were mentioning in the beginning, that like I can do A, B, or C, right? It takes the heaviness of A and B to a point where you can almost make that decision easier. Do you understand what I'm?
Yes.
What I'm saying. Do you have any particular example of that from your experience?
Well, you know, when the car broke down, I could get a new one, get it fixed or kill myself. And I thought, you know, it's probably smart just to have it fixed because a new one, I'll have to make payments.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's an odd conversation. You know, most people don't have a conversation with themselves where one of the options is, you know, financing, fixing, or just kill myself. I wonder, you know, most people don't have those.
Yeah.
But it's just a way of reducing stress. I think it's just a coping mechanism for those of us who have that. And I believe, I did a talk called Mental with Benefits, The Evolutionary Advantages of Mental Illness, because there's so many talented people with a mental illness.
Yep.
I believe that my depression and thoughts of suicide are simply the flip side of my creativity, imagination, comic ability, because it's the same brain. I could teach you to write stand-up and perform stand-up. I can't teach you to process the incoming information the way my brain does. I'll be someplace, and we all hear the same thing. But I'll fire off a line, a punchline for whatever it was. And, you know, I was at the airport and the plane was delayed, mechanical problems. I'm at the gate, standing under a television set on the television to CNN. And the guy standing next to me, and everybody's grubby because we're going to be late. Guy standing next to me goes, hey, how do we get this TV turned to Fox News? And I said in a loud voice so everybody could hear me, well, you kill me first. Boom. I'm the only one who had that thought, I'm sure. And that's just the way my brain works. You know, it's just the way it, and lightning fast. I mean, people ask me sometimes when I was doing comedy, somebody would yell something at me and I'd fire back. A woman was being thrown out of the club and she turned around. And she goes, F you. And without even missing a beat, I went, not even for practice. And the audience, I got a standing ovation and people came up and asked, how'd you think that up that fast? I didn't think it. When you heard it, I heard it. I had no idea it was coming out. So I think that's that because of the way my brain is wired, that's the positive side of the depression and thoughts of suicide. So
it's a
blessing and a curse.
I think it's really cool, like for lack of a better term, that you do acknowledge the fact that sometimes these pathologies, right, of a neuroatypical person that we think is meant to be a curse and a hindrance can actually be a major blessing, right? When I was working within the special needs school, right, I had past exceptional students. A few of them had autism, loads of them had ADHD. Just how their brains work is absolutely remarkable in what they can achieve and what they can do and what they can memorize. And I'm like, the amount of times they'd point out, oh, you wore this same shirt. Like, yeah, sometimes I would wear the same shirt twice, right? Because I'm like, I'm just doing my laundry. I just wear it. Doesn't smell. I'm like, you wore that yesterday. I'm like, oh, you guys are quite observant, right? And it's just the things that they can pick up. And I'm like, that's actually
a story. Yeah.
And I'm trying to teach them that at the same sense, because they realize that they're a little bit different, especially some of the kids with autism. They're very self-aware and they're like, I know that I think differently. But it's because you think differently that you have this ability to memorize an entire page of a book.
Have them watch my TEDx, Mental with Benefits.
Yeah.
The Evolutionary Advantages of Mental Illness, because I made it for kids, really.
Awesome.
Because I open up by saying, what if those of us with a mental illness are not living with a genetic mutation, but an amazing evolutionary adaptation? And what if mental illness is, as Malcolm Gladwell says in his book, David and Goliath, of such things, a desirable disadvantage? You would never wish it on anybody. However, yeah, it does come with certain advantages. That, and then 2 years later, 60 Minutes did a story about how 30 Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. are hiring people on the spectrum for their special ability. And these people are moving out of their parents' basement for the first time in their lives because they're making a great living doing the one thing. And I've got one of my TEDx coaching clients. She speaks on the power of neurodiversity in the workplace. Wrapping your arms around enhancing, embracing, and energizing whatever it is they do so well. And that's kind of the message for kids is, you know, yeah, you have if we can convince a child you have a mental disability, yes, but you may have some mental abilities your peers can't touch. You know, you may be like Harry Potter. You're half muggle, sure. You got a weird, you know, a lightning bolt on your whatever, but you're a wizard. And what kid didn't want to be special in some way? I believe if we could convince children of that and their peers of that, we can reduce bullying and stigma and eventually suicide, because, you know, it would normalize and they would value these abilities these kids had rather than make fun of them.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think it's to be aware of that. And I was actually going to segue, because I think in the States, I'll check that my facts again, but it's the fourth leading cause of death between 15 and 19 year olds in the States is suicide.
Yes, and during the pandemic, the actual suicide rate came down 1.5%, roughly, except in one demographic, the one you just mentioned. And I was just doing a college showcase. I speak on suicide prevention at colleges because 3 college students a day, every day in the U.S. die by suicide. And I read a study that said 60% of college students self-report anxiety, which is double what it was 10 years ago. And so, you know, with the usual pressures of college and then layer on the pandemic,
yep,
makes it even worse.
Unfortunately, we're going to see that trend probably continue for a while. The anxieties and things that people are experiencing, right? And this almost universal trauma, there's a universal trauma, not almost, it is. In terms of what we're going through as a pandemic, it's going to have impact and it has that impact. And that being said, across all the things that we're experiencing, if you had to tell somebody who just feels that hopelessness, that lostness, and has been brought to suicidal ideation, what's one thing that you would tell them?
Well, I'll get a mental health checkup to start with. Find out, you know, is it depression? Is it depression? Is it a depressive state of bipolar? Is it something else? Mm-hmm. And I also recommend that they get a full physical workout, because I ran into somebody not long ago whose child had gotten somehow exposed to heavy metals, and they realized that he had an excess of heavy metals in the brain that was causing the symptoms of the mental illness. And so they did some chelation or something to get the heavy metals out of his brain. The symptoms cleared up. So I would say a mental health checkup, a physical health checkup, because, you know, sometimes physical health problems manifest as mental health issues. And if your medication is not working, and I talked to 2 women doing a documentary on psychotropics, they said, Frank, a third of people, whatever they're taking really works for them. A third, whatever they're taking, works okay. And the other third doesn't work at all. So 2/3 of what they're prescribing in the U.S. and maybe other places nowadays, there's a DNA cheek swab test. You get a little saliva on a cheek swab. You send it off and they try to match your DNA with whatever psychotropic works best with your metabolism. So there's a lot less go on, doesn't work, taper off, go on, doesn't work, taper off. This precision medicine. So that'd be my advice. Create a self-care plan, because I think, you know, you got something to be at least be able to get out of bed in the morning every day, which that's one of the reasons I have a self-care plan. So I can actually physically get out of the bed in the morning.
It's quite something to realize that our brains actually do like routine and function. We become inherently, we want to be in a state of flow, and our brains will look for certain things. And for a lot of people, unfortunately, that has become, I wake up and I look at my cell phone.
Yeah.
But that has it has its own effects, right? On our cognitive psychology, and even our neuroplasticity is being affected by our cell phones. But that's a whole different topic. Frank, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. I've really appreciated some very insightful thoughts. And people want to follow you. Where can they find you? Where can they find your TEDx?
Well, they can go to The Mental Health Comedian, The Mental Health Comedian, or as we say down in the southern United States, The Mental Health Comedian. Pretty much all my stuff is there. My phone number, my email, a bunch of my TEDx talks. You can go to YouTube and find the TEDx talks. I really would recommend, if you have students who have issues, mm-hmm. if they watch the Mental with Benefits, the Evolutionary Advantages of Mental Illness. I had a father tell me, I was on a ship one time. I told him about the TEDx. He watched it. He has a child who's dyslexic. And in my talk, I say, well, here's the thing. Dyslexics, they have several abilities beyond the average person, generally. One is they have better peripheral vision. And two is they have the uncanny ability to pick out the anomaly in anything. And the joke I wrote was, never play Where's Waldo, that kid's game. Never play Where's Waldo with a dyslexic for money, because you're going to lose.
Yeah.
Because they're going to spot it right away. And I believe if you took somebody like that who's dyslexic and they have this ability to spot an anomaly, steer them toward a career that will take advantage of that. Like if the kid had OCD.
Yep.
Well, why not steer them toward a career where attention to detail is prized and rewarded, like accounting, banking, engineering, where it's very important you get all the details just right. Why not take advantage of that ability rather than fight against it?
It is about steering, and I think education needs to do that. The education system has remained the same for far too long. And in most countries, it doesn't just matter where you're at, right? I mean, there's a few other countries that are trying to be a bit more progressive towards that. But yeah, we have to differentiate.
And I think not just curriculum, not just STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, or humanities, depending. And again, humanities is a much better curriculum for somebody with dyslexia, because science, technology, engineering, mathematics, numbers and letters just rolling around on the page. I have an acquaintance who worked with me on the ships. He was a musician. He taught high school band. And he said, Frank, my best musicians were the kids with ADD and ADHD. The problem was, you sit them down and you ask them to practice for 50 minutes, and the first 10 minutes they get better, the next 40 minutes, complete waste of time. So, because they're spending all their energy just trying to sit still after 10 minutes. So he said, on a hunch, he bought an egg timer. And he set the egg timer for 10 minutes. He said to the kid, okay, practice your scale so the egg timer goes off. Egg timer goes off at 10 minutes. Okay, and he sets it back to 10 minutes. Now let's practice those two pieces you're going to be doing at the concert this weekend. 10 minutes, ding. And now let's practice our breathing for 10 minutes, ding. And the improvement in the child's musical performance skyrocketed, because it wasn't just the curriculum, it was the teaching method.
Yep.
That 10-minute, they can sit still for 10 minutes, do something for 10 minutes, but they need something after that. They need to focus on something else, which I thought was just flat brilliant.
I love this conversation, because we're just reminding people that all these things, right, whether it be suicidal ideation, whether it be you going through depression, all these things, there's a flip side and a positive side to it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't wish depression on anybody. And like you were mentioning, is I was diagnosed with depression because I developed meningitis. And I was getting all these symptoms, and they're like, whatever we're doing isn't working for you. So what is going on here? Psychiatrist came and saw me. He's like, oh yeah, he's depressed.
Ah. Yeah. Yeah, made my point. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder. It was 3 years after my brother's death. So these things isn't just, it's not a quick thing. Like immediately you just become depressed. It can actually show its face a lot later.
Oh, sure.
Going to the positive side of that, I've learned so much more about people, and I've learned so much more about joy because of depression. And a lot of people don't understand that. And I'm Christian as well. And people are like, how can you be Christian and depressed? I've had other Christians tell me that. I was like, I've learned so much more. Yeah. These conversations that I've had, I'm like, I've learned so much more about God and what God's love is for me.
Sure.
Through my depression than anybody else, right? So Thank you. It's a great reminder, and I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you taking the time, and
yeah,
keep doing the incredible work that you're doing. Honestly, be pointing people to you. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks for letting me do it in my mobile unit with my German Shepherds in the back for quite some time.